I'm Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 41 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week, David Joy joins us from the snowy mountains of North Carolina to talk about his much-anticipated debut novel, Where All Light Tends to Go. And it's not just that Where All Light Tends to Go is anticipated, it's the wide range of media outlets who are making note of the novel's publication. It may seem like a disconnect, but everyone from Mountain Times and Garden and Gun magazine to Cosmopolitan has put Where All Light Tends to Go on their must-read lists. David Joy knows there's a reason such a disparate group thinks its readership will appreciate his remarkable novel, and he discusses that and much more during our interview. Here's David Joy. Welcome back. Okay. I'm so excited that this week's guest is David Joy, whose Where All Light Tends to Go is scheduled for publication in early March. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
I've been following you on Twitter, and Where All Light Tends to Go is a much anticipated novel. You've gotten call-outs in Mountain Times and Library Journal and, correct me if I'm wrong, Cosmopolitan?
Yeah. Yeah, that last one's a little funny.
Was that a surprise?
I think Cosmopolitan definitely was. And it was kind of funny. One of the men who that book is dedicated to, he passed away this past fall, but... Online, his daughter had posted something that she saw my book in her magazine. And given the time period, I thought she was talking about Garden and Gun because they did a really nice piece showing my book and Jamie Cornegie's Soil and Neil Walsh's My Sunshine Away. And so I asked her if it was Garden and Gun. She said, no. I said, well, what magazine is it? She said, Cosmo. And then she said that, you know, I was just shocked, and so I sent it to Putnam, and they were even surprised by it. Usually, you know, they know everything that's coming down the pipe, but they weren't even aware that book was going to be featured.
Well, and we'll get to Garden and Gun in a second. I'm wondering, does being recommended by Cosmo make Where All Light Tends to Go chick lit?
I would definitely struggle for anybody to think that it's chick lit. But at the same time, I think it's hard to ever say that any piece of literature is you know, something that's written strictly for men or strictly for women. Some of my favorite literature might be something like Jeanette Winterson or something, a lesbian writer, but, you know, that... And I typically, I doubt that I would do the audience she's intending, but, you know, I love her work. So I have a hard time saying that anything's, you know, meant for any particular audience. What I do like is that one of the things they point out in Cosmopolitan is you know, this balance of a violent world mixed with elements of hope, and particularly more of a traditional love story. That's something that Tommy O'Dell had also pointed out, and that's really nice. I hope that helps give it more of a universal appeal.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because my next question is about genre, which I think is a kind of a funny thing. Your book is about criminals, some of whom commit crimes in its pages, and there's plenty of suspense, but it's not really a mystery. What sort of, if you had to choose a genre designation, which you don't, but if you did, what would it be?
This is kind of a funny question. I listened to that, to your podcast with Neil a couple weeks ago. You asked him about the idea of Southern literature. And for me, my book is Southern literature. I'm coming out of a thing of, my idols are most of them died in the past 10 years, but Larry Brown and William Gay and Barry Hanna and Harry Cruz, Ron Rash, who's still here. But that's very much where I'm coming out of. I think early on, I I tried to market that book as an idea of Appalachian noir. And what I was getting at there was I was playing around with, Daniel Woodrell had called, I think it was when either Give Us a Kiss came out or Tomato Red came out. He coined that term country noir, which he eventually kind of separated himself from. But I was playing around with that. One thing that I am coming to notice, though, is that a lot of the people who write noir, their influences aren't my influences. And they're familiar with a whole lot of literature that I'm not familiar with. At the same time, you know, a lot of times they like to categorize. I was having this conversation the other day with someone, they would categorize something like Larry Brown's Joe or Larry Brown's Father and Son, and they would say that's noir. Well, until the popularity of that genre title, it's not noir. It's just Southern literature. And so I think a lot of times the grit lit that comes out of the South, can easily be identified within other genres. But as far as what I'm trying to do, those are the writers that I'm coming out of, and that's the type of literature that I'm interested in.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Emma Walsh's book, and I didn't want to give the impression that I didn't think it was a book in the Southern tradition. I just thought the story could have taken place in any suburb in the United States. The way the people acted and reacted, though, I thought was very Southern.
I think that's that, James Joyce, they asked him why he wrote about Dublin, and he said, because if I can get to the heart of Dublin, I can get to the heart of every city in the world. He had this concept of finding the universal for the particular. And I think that's what Neil does well, and I think that hopefully that's what I'm doing well. I think when you read really great literature, it speaks to you not because of place, but because of the humanity of it. And so, for instance, something like, Colin McCann, I can read his work, and even though I've only visited New York, very briefly, it's not a story that's essential to being from New York or being familiar with that environment. It's something that hits a lot deeper than that. I think that's what all great literature strives for.
You actually answered, you anticipated one of my questions, because I'm not from the South. I'm from Southern California, which has its own kind of literary tradition, but I don't think of it as a literary tradition that the South has, that the writers that are distinct to the South and the voice and the subject matter. I see a difference. I do see a difference. And I think you've done a great job of defining it, even though it's something that's really hard to define.
Yeah.
But while we're on the subject of Southern letters, how great is Garden and Gun magazine? I just think it's amazing.
Yeah, I told someone not long ago, I think that in a lot of ways that's the definitive magazine of the Southern home and the rural Southern home, in that, there's something in there for everybody. Two of my favorite magazines, as far as magazines out of the South, are Oxford American and Garden and Gun. They ran a heritage hunt recently, and the heritage hunt was somewhere in North Carolina, but east of where I grew up. But it was a heritage hunt about people raising beagles to hunt rabbits. I read that story, and it was like, those are my people. That's a magazine that very strongly understands the American South, and not only the American South of the past, but also where we're moving currently.
And one of the things I appreciate, a friend of mine, John Maroney, writes for it from time to time. And one of the things I really like about it is devoid of stereotype for those of us who don't live in the American South. It's a window into, as you said, sort of, you know, inside a Southern family's home and all the different influences. And I think that that's, I think the South is a mysterious place to those of us who haven't lived there. And
I think that's right. I think it gives a very accurate portrayal, for the most part, especially of the rural South, a lot of the traditions that come out of that.
Okay, well, let's get back to where all light tends to go, because that's...
Okay.
It's a very intimate story. I mean, if you said that, you know, Cosmo described it as a love story, that's it. At its core, it's a love story. But it deals with some incredibly weighty themes, fate, free will, nature versus nurture, trust, and innocence. Was one of those themes more influential than the other when you were writing, or am I completely wrong?
I think it's the, I'm dealing with, you know, balancing polarities. And so I'm playing a lot with ideas of light and dark. As far as a major theme, I think the biggest theme in that book is the idea of hope versus fate. And so where I grew up and a lot of the people that I grew up around, you know, they hoped for things, especially when they were really young. They had a lot of hope to, and aspiration to kind of exceed where they had come from. But as time went on, it became clear that you know, the circumstances that they were born into helped to kind of solidify where they were going to be in life. And so hope kind of took a back seat to fate in a lot of ways. And I think that's at the heart of that novel. That's the biggest issue that Jacob is facing. Is this balance of he desperately wants to get away from everything he's been born into, and he simply can't. And so I think that's probably, you know, the biggest issue in that novel.
Well, it's you really feel for Jacob throughout the whole book, every step of the way. You know, you feel like you're with him, and if you're invested in the story, there's a little bit of frustration because you desperately want to help him.
Yeah.
But some things just can't be fixed. Would you say that's true?
Oh, I think it's definitely true. I was having this conversation with someone interviewing me recently, and he couldn't really fathom the type of lifestyle that I was talking about. One of the things that I told him, he couldn't understand being 18 years old and not having hope. And what I told him is where I grew up, 18 years old is when hope died. And what I mean by that is that for a lot of people I grew up around, you know, when you're a kid and you're outside shooting jump shots in the driveway, you fully believe that if you work hard enough, you know, you could play college basketball and that could be your out. Or you fully believe that when your teacher says you can be anything you want to be, that's truthful. But I think for a lot of people born into circumstances like Jacob, as time goes on, you start to realize that, you know, the world's not interesting. You know, number one, you lack the talent to, you know, go play professional basketball or something. But not only that, but, you know, the odds are just stacked against you. There are people who make it out of those situations, but 90% of those people don't. And so I think Jacob is very indicative of a lot of the people that I grew up watching.
It's a beautiful and it's both a beautiful and a brutal landscape where Jacob McNeely lives. And is this an accurate recreation of the, and please excuse me if I pronounce it wrong, the Appalachians of North Carolina?
Latchins.
Latchins.
The Appalachians. There
Appalachians.
Yeah. But yeah, if you if you were to fly here right now and me pick you up in Asheville and we drive an hour west to where I live and I brought you to Jackson County, I could show you everything in that novel. It is a very beautiful landscape, but it's also a very rugged environment. I think landscape plays a really important role in that novel. In a lot of ways, there's really two ways that you can live in the mountains, and a lot of people who come here will describe feeling trapped by the mountains because, you know, you're down in the valley of something and you're surrounded. There's definitely a feeling of being surrounded and being trapped, but there's also a feeling of being nestled and kind of like the world is holding you in the palm of its hand. And so for a lot of ways, Ron Rice, for instance, he's always said that landscape becomes destiny. And in Appalachia, I think that's very true. I think that the landscape comes to govern a lot of and I think landscape, particularly an Appalachian landscape, comes to govern the way that you view the world and the way that you view your own life. It's a constant reminder of how small you are. There are just a whole lot of things that run through your mind when you're surrounded by mountains.
When I met you in October, and hadn't read the book, I can't remember who, but someone likened it. They mentioned that it was, you know, Appalachian noir, redolent of Justified, which is at least a cultural touch point most people can relate to. It didn't really remind me of Justified, except for the descriptions of the landscape, mostly from season one and season two, which I thought were the best seasons, where the landscape and the physicalness of where they live influences what they do and how they do it.
Yeah.
As I said, I follow you on Twitter, and your posts, I think, range from insouciant to serious. And
yeah.
and for one, you know, as I mentioned, where I live in Southern California, we never get snowstorm warnings, so we don't stock up on bread and milk. But I wanted to ask you, do you like social media and the role it plays in marketing your novel? I guess this is more of a question of, you're a creative person, you've written this really wonderful novel. Do you feel that it's a disconnect to have to get out there and tweet about it and talk about it? Is it a comfortable place to be?
I definitely don't think that I'm comfortable with it. At the same time, I recognize how important it is. And it's really interesting, to be able to connect with people all over the country and people all over the world. I think that's really interesting. But I've always been a very shy and a very reclusive person. I typically don't leave my house. Until this past year, I've never been out of the South, and for the most part, I've never been out of North Carolina. To be entirely honest, I'd be fine sitting right here on my front porch until the day that I die. I'm that attached to this place and this landscape. But at the same time, it's an extremely important thing, and it really is, you know, incredibly interesting to be able to talk with and interact with people all over the world. Especially get to meet people and talk to people that you've looked up to for a long time. You know, I love following, for instance, like Benjamin Percy on Twitter. He's hilarious. And he's also very open to where you can actually contact him, interact with him. And so that's interesting.
Well, when I met you, I think that you mentioned, you or the publisher of Putnam mentioned that you had never been on an airplane before. And there you were in California, so you had this sort of, the four horses of the apocalypse, sort of as far as urban America, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, and New York. Did you like the visits, or were you very, very happy to get home?
I don't know. I think there are a lot of things that I really enjoyed. At the same time, you know, that it's stressful to travel that much. Until last year, when I got on an airplane to go to New York to sign those contracts, I'd never been on an airplane. When they tried to set it up, you know, they made it sound like, you know, that's just something you do. You just hop on an airplane and fly on up. And what they couldn't understand was, you know, that's not how I function. So for instance, I bought an extra ticket for my sister, and we flew up there. We arrived at about noon. I was in, you know, Harlem for about 2 hours in traffic. I got there. I met them. I signed the contract, and I got the hell out of there. I was back home by about 7. But this past fall, when we did the Big Suburban Beer Tour, that was interesting because, you know, we were traveling with some really great people. All the team at Putnam is incredible, but Ace Atkins is just such a nice guy. He's, you know, so well traveled, and, you know, he knows all of these towns very well. So that was fun. And it's wonderful to meet people just like you. You know, you go to these places and you start realizing that all of the things you've always grown up believing just are incorrect, and that, you know, that we're just all human. And to me, that's the most beautiful thing. I really loved San Francisco, and I really loved Boston. And so I think there's, you know, it's difficult to travel that much, and it's very difficult when you have the type of anxieties that I have. But at the same time, it's worthwhile when you start meeting really great people.
Well, I'm going to take that as a compliment. Also in your Twitter feed, you said that you finished a short story and that you have started your next book. And I wanted to, and you mentioned about another one of your creations is going to get into trouble. So I was wondering if you could talk about your next novel and, you know, if you've got an idea of where it's going to go and where the story is going to be told geographically. Are you going to stay in Jackson County, or go a little further afield?
I'll definitely still be in Jackson County. When Putnam purchased, where I like things to go, they actually purchased a second novel. And so I finished that, early January, and I'm still working through some edits with my, editor there, but that novel should be out next year. So I've got one finished. And right now it's tentatively called Waiting on the End of the World. That title is most likely going to change. And we're not really sure, you know, what the title will be. But ultimately the trigger event for that novel was that these two men go to buy drugs. The dealer has been taking in all kinds of stolen goods as payment for drugs, and so he's been taking in a lot of stolen firearms. And he's showing off all of these guns, and he ends up accidentally killing himself. And so all of a sudden, you've got these two addicts sitting here with a pile of drugs, and a pile of money, and a pile of guns. And it's just kind of this, you know, that's the catalyst for the narrative. The story eventually became something very much about trauma, and it's these three different characters, each carrying a great burden, and each being governed by some type of traumatic event in their past. And so that book is done. The short story you're talking about is actually I had a request to write a short story for an anthology called Degrees of Elevation, which they've already had one volume out. It's great.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the anthology?
The anthology was called Degrees of Elevation. Okay. And the first volume of that had, you know, it had Ron Rash in it, it had Chris Elsa in it. Had a bunch of really great, it's all Appalachian, contemporary Appalachian writers. But they were going to do a second volume of that. So that's where that short story came from. But I'm very interested in these four characters, and I really think that that's going to be the next novel that I write. And, you know, I'm not under contract for that at all, but that is definitely where my heart is right now. And it's really these four characters who are haunted by things that they've done, but they don't really, it's things that they're unable to seek forgiveness for. And so, for instance, there's a father in this novel that I'm wanting to write that he was an alcoholic his entire life, and by the time he sobers up, his kids are grown, and his wife has developed early onset Alzheimer's, and so she's in a care facility, and he visits her every day, and the only thing he's hoping for is this one moment of lucidity where he might ask her for forgiveness. But it's these four characters who are each carrying something like that, something, you know, that they really want forgiveness for, but they just can't get it.
So it's a story of anticipated redemption.
Yeah.
That's a lot. It gives us something to look forward to. I can't wait to read Waiting on the End of the World, or whatever title it ends up having.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did the title for Where All Light Tends to Go, was that always the title?
Yes, and that's kind of funny. I had the title for that from the beginning, and I don't really know. It's kind of this serendipitous thing because it ends up working so well, and it's such a meaningful title for that novel. And I didn't anticipate it being that, and I certainly didn't try to write the novel to meet that title. But at the same time, that title existed from the very beginning. And really, where that title came from is this really great essay. I'm thinking it's...
It was actually an essay by Aldo Leopold called Thinking Like a Mountain.
It's an essay where he's young and he's seen, he kills this wolf, and he watches the life go out of this wolf's eyes. And that's kind of where that image came from, is watching something die and watching the life pull back out of it. And so the title was always there.
Thank you so much for talking to me about this book. It was, you know, when I got it in October, I started it that night because at least three people took me aside and said, you have to, you know, of all the books that you've received, of the four books you've received tonight, this is the one you have to read. And then I was up until about 3 o'clock.
Oh, thank you very much.
Struggling because I didn't want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
But I think I finished it within two or three days. And then before we spoke, I reread it just to make sure that I remembered everything clearly. And it really is one of those books that you can reread. So if anyone's listening and you've read it once, go back and read it again. You'll see a lot of things that you might have missed the first time as you're, you know, barreling through it, trying to you know, in order to find out what happens. But thank you again. I look forward to your tour. I see you're coming to California, so hopefully I'll get a chance to see you.
Yeah, I'll do that.
And I also see that you're in a joint appearance with Neil Walsh in Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
St. Patrick's Day, and that's the day before, that's on St. Patrick's Day in New Orleans, the day before I fly to Los Angeles. So if I'm crawling off the airplane into Los Angeles, you will all know why.
Thank you again, David. And I would wish you luck with this book, but I don't think you need it. I think it's everything. I think everything that you could possibly want from this, you're going to receive. It's an amazing, amazing book.
Well, thanks.
Next week, Speaking of Mysteries plans to publish 2 podcast interviews. On Monday, March 9th, we'll be talking to C.J. Box about his latest Joe Pickett novel, Endangered. And on Tuesday, March 10th, Julia Dahl, whose debut mystery novel, Invisible City, was nominated for an Edgar Award, will be joining us. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening.